This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Lots of reaction from both sides of the political aisle a day after man yelling, "All these Jews must die," burst into a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania synagogue during Sabbath services Saturday, shooting indiscriminately and killing 11 congregants. Six people, including a police officer who confronted the attacker, were also wounded. President Trump said these kinds of incidents point to the need for armed guards in churches and synagogues.
So this would be a case for, if there was an armed guard inside the temple, they would have been able to stop him. Maybe there would have been nobody killed except for him.
The suspect was armed with a rifle and three handguns when he entered the synagogue, where about 80 people had gathered. On CBS's Face the Nation, Democratic Senator Chris Coons says some politicians, including President Trump, have used their platforms to divide the country.
I think those of us in national office, our president, those who would hope to be president, those of us in Congress who have louder microphones and who are heard from and seen more regularly, need to take responsibility for ways in which we lower the temperature.
And on that same program, Republican Senator James Lankford says President Trump's comments about the caravan in Mexico being supported by globalists can't be blamed for the mass shootings at that synagogue.
This particular shooter also condemned President Trump, saying he was a globalist and that he was allowing some of this to happen. So I don't see any connection where you would connect the president to this particular shooting.
The man who was arrested and charged with mailing at least 13 packages containing explosive devices to critics of President Trump is expected to make his first court appearance on Monday. Cesar Sayoc, a man with a long criminal record, faces five charges. The bombs were addressed to former President Barack Obama, as well as other high-profile Democrats. This is VOA News. Saudi Arabia's top diplomat says the global outcry and media focus on Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's death has become intense. A piece, Charles de Ledesma.
Speaking at an annual conference of international officials, including Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, which is taking place in Bahrain, Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir said the Khashoggi issue has become fairly hysterical, with people assigning blame on Saudi Arabia with such certainty before any probe is complete. He reminded delegates officials are trying to uncover what happened and that a mistake was committed. Al-Jubeir made clear some people had exceeded their authority, but he cautioned, investigations take time. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The UN Refugee Agency is urging Washington to allow people fleeing persecution and violence, including those who are traveling with the Central American caravan, to request asylum on U.S. territory. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
UNHCR spokesman Andrei Mihecic tells VOA his agency has alerted countries along the caravan's route that it is likely to include people in real danger.
Our position globally is that the individuals who are fleeing persecution and violence need to be given access to territory and protection, including refugee status determination procedure. And if the people who are fleeing persecution and violence enter Mexico, they need to be provided access to the Mexican asylum system, and those entering the United States need to be provided access to the American asylum system.
Mihecic says the UNHCR is very concerned about the developing humanitarian situation along the migratory route. He says there are kidnapping and security risks in the areas where the caravan may be venturing.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA. And the last public appearance by Brazilian presidential candidate before this Sunday's elections, Fernando Haddad, warned voters his opponent's proposals to fight crime would only increase violence. Jair Bolsonaro is a frontrunner and is viewed as polarizing. Inter-American Dialogue senior fellow Peter Hakim spoke with VOA about Bolsonaro's popularity.
People see him as talking plainly in plain Portuguese, if you like. He communicates well. He says what he wants. People say we don't need these politicians who beat around the bush and are convoluted in what they say and don't really mean what they say.
Two polls published late Saturday showed that Bolsonaro's advantage falls once again, but still it's a comfortable enough lead to win the election. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Before you can even pick a form, because there are procedures, you have to pick a form to say you want to contest an election.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari moves to prevent mass defections from the ruling party ahead of next year's general election.
Where are we wrong with exams? If we are just going to say we are going to suspend the examination without getting to the bottom of it, we are not solving the problem.
Zambian government cancels national mathematics examinations after the detection of leaked questions.
L'attention des uns des autres.
He says he will not tolerate disorder and will not allow anyone in his region to start any protest that may jeopardize the peace of the country.
Cameroonian anti-riot police arrest a lawyer for the main opposition leader, Maurice Kamto. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is reportedly implementing measures to prevent possible defections from the ruling party, which arose from the crisis generated by the recent primaries. Local media reports say some members wanted to defect to other parties after saying they were not fairly treated by the ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC. This after the primaries were marred by dispute in several states, including Ogun, Adamawa, Bauchi, and Jigawa. To learn more, I reach Abdulrahman Balogun, Assistant Editor-in-Chief with the News Agency of Nigeria in the capital, Abuja.
It has been defection and counter-defection, especially with the people who are not satisfied with the conduct of the primary. Don't forget, we now have 91 registered political parties. Some candidates say that they are popular enough, that their names are popular enough to stand as a flag bearer of a political party. So if they look out in the primary, they will definitely go and see their camp with another party. I think that is what is happening in this democracy, so that people who have enough space to move. So as people are going in to another party, people are coming to APC.
Some APC supporters that we spoke with said it appears there is so much restlessness within the rank and file of the party. They wonder if all these could be put to rest before the February general election. What is your take?
Yes, I agree with you on that. I think I've set up a conciliatory committee at each zone and at the national level to reach out to some of those of them who are agreed at the turnout of the primaries. They are doing that. Some are coming back and some are sticking to their guns. I think it's certainly the normal thing. After the primary, those of them who are wounded, one way or the other, because they didn't secure the ticket. For instance, tomorrow we learn that a state, they are taking a serious protest in Abuja to show that the national hierarchy of the party, they are not fair to them because of the choice of the governorship candidates, according to them, imposed on them by the party.
What about the latest issue of Nigerians demanding to see the certificate of the president? This is not the first time this is coming up. When he was running for the last election, People demanded it. He asked people to go to the military because his entire life was lived while he served in the military. How are people reacting to this?
Well, I'm surprised that the thing is hearing is only heard again this time around. And the point people are saying now is that now is the commander-in-chief. He has access to any records. He can give a directive. If indeed the certificate is in the records of the army, now he has all the commands that are under him. He can give a directive that, okay, go and look into my records and bring my certificate. I think that one is just a little distraction because it's not even constitutional. For somebody who has risen to the position of a general in the Nigerian Army, it is enough. I think there have been some problems with documentation. And I'm of the opinion that if you cannot lay your hand on the original certificate, there are some other procedures you can follow in validating it. One, you can do a sworn court affidavit saying that you are this, but due to this and this and this, you could not lay your hand on. Which, to the best of my knowledge, he has done that. Two, you can go back to your institution and collect what is called a true certified copy, which will be certified by whoever is the new head of your institution.
Do you think all the aspiring candidates, both presidential, legislative, and local, would meet the deadline of Thursday to submit their document alerting the Electoral Commission that they seek to contest in the next February general election?
Yes, I think they should meet it because each political party has been issued already set up what they call screening committee. Before you can even pick a form, because there are procedures, you have to pick a form to say you want to contest an election. Before you can pick a form, you will have faced a screening committee, and in the screening committee, they will ask for some of these credentials. It was through the screening committee, for instance, that the likes of the Minister of Communication, Adebayo Shitu, was disqualified by APC that they cannot run for governor in his state, which is Oyo State.
Abdulrahman Balogun is the assistant editor-in-chief with the News Agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me from Abuja. The Zambian government has cancelled a mathematics examination following reports that the questions were leaked before the scheduled October 23 test. Citing the malpractice, the Ministry of General Education announced the suspension of all grade 7, 9 and 12 final examinations for the year. Investigations are looking into how the questions were leaked, but civil society and opposition groups blame the government for failing to fight corruption, an accusation the government denies. For more reaction, I reach Gregory Siferi, Executive Director for the Southern Africa Network Against Corruption in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
They are angry, really. It's not a pleasant thing because exams are held annually and people plan for these things, that their children, they write exams at a certain period and they make progression. But you see, Peter, the leaking of exams shows a lot of things. There's more to it than what meets the eye. There's generally a big problem at the Ministry of General Education. At the moment as we speak, the permanent secretary was suspended due to issues to do with misappropriation of money because the donors complained this misappropriation has been going on for some time. So the problem that is there is really has to do with maladministration. It starts from the top. There has been a systems failure there. They are failing to manage not only exams, but manage staff and manage everything.
Why should the top leadership of the Ministry of Education be blamed when unscrupulous people engage in acts of corruption, take bribes or money, and then leak exam questions to students?
They learn from the top. At the moment, there is no supervisor. The chief executive at the Ministry of General Education is not there. He's not working, has been suspended because of corruption and misappropriation of more than 4 million donor money. So who is now supervising? Because some of the accountants and directors have also been suspended. They're not working. So who is working there? There's no supervision. And people now feel that they can make money in whatsoever way they feel like making money. And this is not because it is just the lower level stuff, but they learn it from the topmost. Corruption in our country starts from the topmost. Sorry, so to say. Not long ago, the head of state in a function said that you can steal, but do not steal the seed. Like, you can steal the bakery, but you can steal the bread, but don't steal the bakery.
But some people are saying some people are saying that is just a figure of speech, and that his administration is fighting against corruption in all forms, and that if people have proof of any of his cabinet ministers or officials of the government engaging in acts of corruption, they can submit their proof so those people could be dealt with according to law.
Really, that is rhetoric, because only last month, at the beginning of October, the president fired his Minister for Community Development and Social Welfare for misappropriation of donor money, because the donors complained. But if ordinary citizens and the civil society and the others complain to the president without pressure from the donor community, they would not act. The evidence is being brought to the table, but institutions such as the Anti-Corruption Commission, the Drug Enforcement Commission, are being controlled by State House.
This is not the first time where exam questions have been leaked to people in Zambia. Critics say that you are just accusing the administration for the sake of accusation, just what civil society groups are doing to join forces with the opposition parties to accuse the government of indifference to fight against corruption, when this has been a problem for all this while.
Well, in previous administrations, there have been this problem, yes, but it's not up to the levels that we have seen now, because exam leakages are in social media, they are everywhere. Students are sending each other using WhatsApp, they're sending each other using whatever platform that could be there. You see, they could go to any school and these examination leakages are available to the highest bidder, simply because the levels of hunger and poverty have reached levels that we have not seen in many, many years, maybe since 1991. Where are we wrong with exams? If we are just going to say we are going to suspend the examination without getting to the bottom of it, we are not solving the problem. The problem is that the people that are working in examinations are poorly remunerated. The buying power of the Kwacha has lost value for about 100% from 2011 to now. What the Kwacha used to buy then cannot buy now.
Gregory Sifiri is the executive director for the Southern Africa Network Against Corruption. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Cameroonian anti-riot police have arrested at least 24 people, including Ndoki Michel, a lawyer who defended Maurice Kamto, the man who claims he won the October 7 presidential election. The protesters are asking President Paul Biya to immediately hand over power to Kamto, promising to continue the demonstrations until the will of the people is respected. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Hundreds of people, a majority of them youths, on Saturday marched and sang on the streets of Cameroon's economic capital city, Douala, calling for Cameroon President Paul Biya to step down immediately. Bosco Etunde, a 23-year-old university graduate, says protesters believe Maurice Kamto of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement political party, who ran against Paul Biya in Cameroon's October 7 presidential election and was declared runner-up with 14% of the votes, actually won the election. He says he wants Kamto to immediately take power, as he is tired of seeing only one president who does not provide for residents' needs. He says youths make up more than 70% of Cameroon's population, but Biya has never been involving the younger generation in decision-making. He says after students complete their studies, they remain jobless because Biya is not creating jobs. He says a change is needed. Witnesses say some of the protesters were beaten and dragged through the mud. Cameroon police reported more than 24 arrests of protesters, including Michel Ndoki,
a lawyer who defended Kamto at the Constitutional Council, where the alleged massive fraud and ballot stuffing in favor of Biya's ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement CPDM party. However, Kamto's Cameroon Renaissance Movement said 42 people, including some of its party officials, have been arrested and are still being detained. The Constitutional Council rejected the petition, and Kamto, who had earlier claimed victory, announced what he called a national resistance program in regards to Biya's inauguration ceremony in December, although no date has yet been announced. Ivaha Dibua, governor of the littoral region of Cameroon where Douala is located, says he will never tolerate any disorder in his administrative area, and anyone who creates disorder will face police action.
Nous appelons l'attention des uns des autres.
He says he will not tolerate disorder and will not allow anyone in his region to start any protest that may jeopardize the peace of the country. He says Cameroon respects people's freedoms, but that no one should abuse the freedom by denigrating, insulting and stigmatizing others, claiming that they felt cheated. Besides Douala, minor protests were reported in the cities of Yaoundé and Bafoussam, but were quickly contained by police. Biya, who has been in power for 36 years, was declared the winner of the country's October 7 presidential poll, winning 71% of the vote. His runner-up, Kamto, who won 14% of the vote, has rejected the results. In 2008, Biya removed term limits from the constitution, allowing him to serve indefinitely. He is now the second oldest president in sub-Saharan Africa. When his new term is finished, he will be 93 years old. Kamto's MRC party has vowed to continue with the protests until Biya steps down. In a statement Saturday, he calls for police to release those who have been arrested, stating that they were simply expressing their discontent at the election. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Until recently, history classes in the U.S. focused almost exclusively on American and European history. Millennia of African history were either downplayed, misrepresented, or ignored. An upcoming museum exhibit at Northwestern University in Chicago will help right that balance by showcasing the vast cultural and material wealth that traveled from present-day Morocco, Nigeria and Mali to Europe during medieval times, roughly from the 8th to the 16th century. VOA's Adam Phillips has more from New York.
It was the New York preview of the Block Museum's upcoming show, Caravans of Gold, Fragments in Time, and museum director Lisa Corin looked pleased. She hopes the exhibit will help change how Americans think about African history.
In the United States, our children grow up from the time they're little knowing only two things about the continent of Africa. One is slavery, and one is the masks that they see in art museums. This exhibition is an effort to change that, to hearken back to a time when there were some of the greatest civilizations ever in the world.
Arguably, the greatest African civilization in the medieval world was the Empire of Mali, which controlled access to what was perhaps the most plentiful source of pure gold Europeans had ever seen. There was also abundant ivory and salt.
And of course, what comes out of that are spectacular works of art. These gold leaf panel paintings that we associate with Italy and the wonderful illuminated manuscripts that we see in France at the time. But also then, you know, the encounters with people who speak languages that you don't understand, who believe in religions that you've never heard of, the adventurousness of it.
During the 8 years of research and preparation for the show, curator Kathleen Burzak made extensive use of written accounts by Arab traders traveling between Africa and Europe. Several mentioned shields made of auroch skin, an example of which will be displayed in the exhibit.
These were made in the Mali Empire or preceding the Mali Empire in the Ghana Empire, so across the region of the Western Sudan. And these were transported across the desert and used in warfare by the Umayyads of Spain or the Granada Empire. Moroccan leather very often is actually hide that is transported across the Sahara, worked in Morocco. And there's a whole kind of culture of leather and leather working that is really, really interesting.
Most of the medieval objects made of cloth, wood, and other delicate materials have disintegrated over the centuries. But the exhibit does feature a case of fragments archaeologists have found. Berzak attempts to bring these fragments to life by pairing them with intact examples of similar objects on loan to the show from partner museums.
So in the exhibition, you'll see things like lusterware. It's a type of beautifully glazed ceramicware, and gold jewelry, and ivory sculpture, and manuscripts, and terracotta sculpture. And one of the things that was being transported northward from the forest and the savanna was ivory. And so in the exhibition, there are 13th century ivory sculptures of the Virgin and Child from France. So we're bringing that all together to paint a picture or to reveal a portrait of what this period looked like at its widest extent.
While the riches often flowed from Africa to Europe, significant cultural wealth also flowed back to Africa from Europe. For example, a fine 13th century copper figure of a seated man on display was probably made in Ife, Nigeria. But experts believe the sculpture may have been cast in the European Alps. Also on display is a pottery shard from China. Archaeologists say it was probably carried through Asia along the Silk Road, then conveyed via the Middle Eastern trade routes, and finally picked up by caravans crossing the Sahara to Mali. It's another humble yet intriguing object in the Caravans of Gold, Fragments in Time exhibit that speaks to Africa's glorious history as a medieval world market. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
In a highly unusual move, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is demanding the government of Burundi apologize for its inflammatory personal attacks against members of the Independent Commission of Inquiry, impugning their credibility. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
On Wednesday, Burundi's ambassador, Albert Shingiro, verbally attacked and threatened to prosecute members of the Independent Commission of Inquiry at a meeting of the General Assembly's Third Committee in New York. Among other virulent statements, he compared the chair of the commission, Dudu Diane, to a participant in the slave trade. High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet calls these remarks reprehensible and disgraceful. She's demanding a retraction and apology from the government of Burundi. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA, Burundi is one of the 47 members of the UN Human Rights Council, a position that comes with enhanced responsibilities.
This is a member state of the United Nations and of the Human Rights Council attacking the members of a commission of inquiry set up and appointed by the Human Rights Council and attacking them with threats of legal prosecution, as well as personally attacking them using very inflammatory language referring to the slave trade. This is clearly unacceptable.
The Commission of Inquiry on Burundi was established September 2016. The three-member commission has issued several reports documenting widespread human rights violations in the country, including some that may constitute crimes against humanity. The government has never cooperated with the commission or granted it access to the country. It has rejected the reports as being politically biased and based on campaigns of disinformation. Shamdasani says the Human Rights Office stands by the facts in the reports. She calls on Burundi to examine the reports and to consider the serious allegations of violations contained within. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa is praising South Sudan for improving its maternal and neonatal health care despite the nearly 5 years of conflict. Dr. Matidiso Moeti says the government has made huge gains in reducing maternal mortality. For VOA, Waki Simon Wood reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
The WHO's Dr. Matsidisho Moyeti says, although challenges still remain, South Sudan has significantly reduced maternal mortality across the country. Moyeti did not identify the exact areas where maternal health care has improved, but she told journalists in Juba this week that peace and stability in South Sudan would help health workers address the challenges facing pregnant women.
There's been a huge amount of progress made in putting the infrastructure in place, increasing the human resources, and as I said, actually improving the health in terms of some of the key indicators here in South Sudan, including reducing maternal mortality, which started off at a very high rate. Secondly, I think that the implementation of the peace agreement is very important for the further progress to be made. So hopefully all the parties concerned are very aware of that. This is what I have been assured with.
In 2011, South Sudan was ranked as one of the countries among the highest maternal mortality rate in the world. The country registered 2,054 infant deaths out of 100,000 births. That figure has dropped to 789 deaths in 100,000 births in 2018. Repent Kamis George is the national chairperson of the South Sudan Nurses and Midwifery Association, a body formed in 2010 to improve maternal and neonatal health across South Sudan. Kamis says traditional birth attendants are still handling maternal health issues in most remote parts of South Sudan. He says the number of healthcare workers should be doubled across South Sudan.
One of the factor is the training of the mid-level health cadre, and particularly the training of midwives. The training of midwives and nurses, that could have been one of the factors, because what was realized earlier is that the skilled birth attendants were not enough. They were very few. That's why the government, in particular the Minister of Health, its partners, established a number of training institutions, specifically training nurses and midwives in this country.
South Sudan has trained some 600 nurses and midwives across South Sudan, according to Kamis. Juba Teaching Hospital, the Meridi Health Institute, the Catholic Health Institute, and the Med Help Institute in Wau are some of the primary training institutions in the country. But Kamisi says these institutions are not enough to serve South Sudan's population of 11 million.
One of the strategies could be still training, opening more schools to train more numbers, because the health science institutions currently training nurses and midwives are not covering the whole country. You know, they're only in the specific places like Juba, Wau, Meridi, and so it's not covering the whole country.
After visiting some of the healthy facilities in Wau and Juba teaching hospitals, Moyeti donated 4 ambulances and $50,000 to the Ministry of Health to help address the challenges facing South Sudan's healthcare system. Only 2.5% of South Sudan's budget of 81 billion South Sudanese pounds is allocated to the Ministry of Health this year. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A Zimbabwean Commission of Inquiry investigating election violence held hearings Friday in the country's second largest city, Bulawayo. President Emmerson Mnangagwa appointed the body following the deaths of 6 people after the July polls. For VOA, Adi Gondo has more on the development, which took place at Friday's public hearing from Bulawayo.
The Commission of Inquiry is chaired by the former president of South Africa, Kgalema Motlanthe, and includes high-profile figures such as Rodney Dixon, QC of the United Kingdom, Chief Emeka Anyaoku, a former Commonwealth Secretary General from Nigeria, and the former Chief of Defense Forces of the Tanzania People's Defense Forces, General Davis Mwamunyange. Local academics are also in the commission, including Wimbai Nyemba, former president of the Law Society of Zimbabwe, and two from the University of Zimbabwe, political science lecturer Charity Manyeruke, and Faculty of Law Professor Lavmo Maduku. The commission is working to identify actors in the protests and their motives and the events leading up to the violence on August 1, when six people were allegedly shot dead by the army. It will also examine the role of the police and the army in the maintenance of law and order. The commission came to Bulawayo to hear from members of the public, especially those who may have been in Harare at the time of the shooting. They also wanted to hear suggestions on how to avoid future election-related violence. The meeting was, however, halted after it had been disrupted by disgruntled members of the audience who were alleged to be with the Mtwakazi Republic Party. They were accused of interrupting witnesses. Some observers say the chaotic outcome was predictable, as groups such as MRP would use the hearing to highlight the atrocities committed in Matabeleland between 1983 and 1980. Mtwakazi Republic Party Secretary General Akim Gasela Mklanga says the commission's visit to Bulawayo was not necessary because the August 1 killings of six people occurred in Harare.
We saw it before that this commission has nothing to do with the people of Matabeleland. This thing that is happening here, it has nothing to do with the peace and justice. That is a thing to justify the international community that Mnangagwa, of course, has now become someone to put trust on. But I don't think the international community must trust what is happening in Zimbabwe, this so-called new dispensation. It has nothing to do with the people of Matabeleland.
During the hearings, there were skirmishes triggered by the MRP's violent reaction to a provocative response by an audience member who interrupted one of the party officials giving testimony. Chairs flew in the auditorium and police said to howl out the rowdy members, with the meeting being adjourned for a lunch break. Some of the party members were later arrested. The MRP was criticized for the violent out, but Mhlanga blamed it on him.
You know, people are angry, my friend. Emotions are high. So the government must make sure that they cool down the emotions. The government must see that the people who have been, who have been victimized. As you can see, they are arresting someone right now. Things are happening. The commission, if it comes back, if these people who are setting the commission are not genuine of what they are doing, it will remain like this. It have to start with the Zimbabwean government. They must be genuine in everything they are doing.
Some observers say that because no deaths occurred on August 1 in Bulawayo, as it happened in Harare, hardliners like the MRP will interpret Friday's hearings as window dressing. Also attending the proceedings were members of the opposition MDCT party led by Thokozani Kuphe. Party members such as Mbuso Sibanda seized the opportunity to lambast the opposition MDC alliance and the ruling ZANU-PF. They linked the violence in Harare to a culture of violence massacres in the 1980s. Alec Gumede is the organizing secretary of the MDC team.
Very bad thing. I will cry together with the people of Harare. But what I want to just put in front of this commission is that everything that we see happening in this country is perpetrated by ZANU-PF. ZANU has overstayed. It has got plans to keep itself in the ruling position. We have seen it happening during the time of elections.
One of the recommendations aired by one of the speakers regarded the dismantling of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission as a way of preempting future violence during elections. Observers say ZEC is heavily militarized and perceived to be biased. The manner in which it announced the July 30 results in a haphazard way were cited as one of the causes of the violence and for the loss of life. A 73-year-old former freedom fighter, Mr. Moyo, said the electoral body needs to be reformed.
It must be presided by retired judges, civic organizations, church leaders.
The commission heads to Gweru for another public hearing. This after the arrest of three MRP members who were allegedly involved in skirmishes at the Bulawayo public hearings. One of those arrested was Superman Lamaf on a charge of undermining the country's president whilst giving testimony. He questioned the motives of a hearing that could not guarantee the freedom of those like himself who testified. He says the body had promised that those who took part would be protected. The commission is expected to submit the report to the president of Zimbabwe within 3 months. Reporters could not access the heavily guarded commissioners who were bundled into vehicles and sped away after the hearings. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to another edition of Nightline Africa Sports. In football, Egypt's Al Ahly lost 2-1 in Algeria in the second leg of the African Champions League semi-final. But despite the loss, the Egyptians reached a 12th Champions League final with a 3-2 aggregate win over a 10th Sétif. Ahly now face Esperance in November's final after the Tunisians beat Angola's Primeiro de Agosto 4-3 overall. Another Egyptian club, Al Masry, left the pitch in protest of a goal as they lost 4-0 to AS Vita Club in the second leg of the Confederation Cup semi-final. The DR Congo side won the tie 4-0 on aggregate and will face Raja Casablanca in the two-leg final. The Moroccan team beat visiting Nigerian club Enyimba 2-1 on Wednesday to complete a 3-1 aggregate victory. Raja Casablanca will host the first leg of the final on November 25th with a return match a week later in Kinshasa. The Masry players walked off the pitch in the 75th minute when they believed Jean-Marc Makusu's goal was offside, but replays showed the strike was legitimate. Play resumed after 5 minutes with Mokoko Batesadio completing the rout in stoppage time. Meanwhile, the draw for this year's Women's Africa Cup of Nations was made in Accra, with the defending champions Nigeria drawn alongside South Africa, Zambia and Kenya in Group B. The 2018 hosts Ghana will face Algeria, Mali and Cameroon in Group A of the Showpiece Women's Football Tournament in Africa. Ghana will kick off the competition against Algeria at the Accra Sports Stadium on Saturday, November 17th, with the final set for December 1st. Nigeria are the most successful team in the history of the competition, with 8 titles from 10 editions. The Super Falcons will open their campaign against South Africa on November 18th in Cape Coast. Kenya are in Nigeria's group, replacing Equatorial Guinea, who were disqualified for fielding an ineligible player. Ghana has never won the women's continental title, but have been the losing finalist on 3 occasions, 1998, 2002 and 2006. The top 2 sides in the groups will progress to semifinals. This year's competition will also produce the African qualifiers for the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup. Elsewhere, in FIFA's latest rankings, Namibia and Zambia both gained 7 places overall, while Egypt, Madagascar and Burundi all moved up 6 spots. The movements all come after October's back-to-back Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. Gibraltar were the biggest movers in October, moving 8 places after their first ever international wins. Tunisia remain the top-ranked side in Africa and are up 1 place to 22nd globally. World Cup winners France dropped 1 place to leave Belgium, the highest-ranked team overall, by just 1 point. And African champions Cameroon will play 5-time World Cup winners Brazil on November 20th in Milton Keynes. The friendly was confirmed on the Brazilian Football Association's Twitter page. Cameroon are preparing to host the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations, and the Brazil game comes just 4 days after they play Morocco in a qualifier. Finally, in athletics, 1 year after his compatriot Jocelyn Kipkosgei broke the women's world record in Valencia, Kenya's Abraham Kiptum broke the men's world record at the IAAF Gold Labor Road Race, clocking 58.18 to take 5 seconds off the mark set by Eritrea's Zesane Tadesi in 2010. Held alongside the men's event, the lead pack in the women's race cruised through the opening 5 kilometers in 15.39 with the fastest entrant, Kenya's Edith Chelimo, at the front, closely followed by the Ethiopian trio of Bekelechi Gudeta, Gelete Boko, and Helen Bekele Tola. But with only 800 meters left, Buka used her track pedigree to unleash a change of speed, building a 15-meter advantage over Said and win in a personal best of 1 hour, 6 minutes and 11 seconds, beating her previous best of 108.18 set at the same venue last year. Said finished second in a national record of 106.13, while pre-race favorite Chelimo had settled for third in 106.17. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
Love is the beautiful thing created by God.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And I
Sunajua siku kuni leo. Hello, baby. Sunajua siku yetu leo. Hello, baby. Sunajua nakuoa leo. Hello, baby. Kile keki twalikata leo. Hello, baby.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. For decades, the international community has applauded the way Africans have been treating refugees and migrants humanely, sometimes at great financial cost. In reports of the United Nations Refugees Agency, Africa hosts 26% of the world's refugee population. And five countries in Africa, mainly in East Africa, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and others, have been hosting refugees for decades. In fact, the largest refugee camp today is in Kenya, where exceedingly large numbers of Somali refugees are hosted. So it was a surprise to learn recently that the government of Angola has been expelling massive number of Democratic Republic of Congo migrants to the DRC. And the argument has been that this has been done violently, violating their basic human rights. The government of Angola has denied these allegations and have argued that some of the illegal miners have been going back to the DRC voluntarily, but others do not share the view of the government of Angola. And last week, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, added a concern to this massive expulsion of DRC migrants from Angola, calling on the government to desist and observe the human rights of the DRC citizens. There's also concern that any massive inflow of migrants from Angola might affect the social stability in the neighboring countries, particularly at a time when the world community is trying to contain the outbreak of Ebola, and there are preparations for a crucial election in the DRC on the 23rd of December. But let us take a pause and ask ourselves, why is it that the Angolan government might be taking such action? In the last few years, we have seen a rising tide of opposition against migrants and refugees around the world, particularly in so-called mature democracies. In these countries, the need to expel migrants has become a political football, and governments are being elected or unelected on these issues. And as we speak, most governments are finding ways to expel these migrants. Is it possible that African governments are observing this tide of opposition against migrants and maybe learning very bad example? In the United States at this moment, we are seeing a spectacle of a caravan from Central America being used as a political ploy in a very crucial election. It should be borne in mind that these developments outside of the continent may have negative impact. One will only hope that these developments and these retrograde steps outside the continent does not affect the posture of African governments towards refugees and migrants. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, reporter Douglas Impoga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the frog does not jump in the middle of the day without reason. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.